2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2, Ruth Adelson and Hope Layton, interviewing Irene Jacob, August 3rd, 2000. Irene, would you please tell us your address?
My address is 303 Leroy Road, Pittsburgh, 15208.
Do you want to check it, Ruth?
Mm-hmm. Okay, we can start now.
Okay. Thank you, Irene, for letting us come back. And first, I'd like to fill in some of the gaps that I noticed when I listened to the tape. Tell me about your brother, Ailey. Is he still in Israel?
My brother, Ailey, is still in Israel. Mm-hmm. He is, he worked the tech at Haifa, and he's a chemist, and he just retired. He wrote a book, which has, sorry, I can't think of the name at the moment, but it has been translated into many, many different languages.
He's a chip off the family block,
I see. Yes, yeah.
And his full name is Ailey Lowenthal.
Ailey Lowenthal,
okay.
Yeah. Okay. He's called
Ailey. E-L-I.
E-L-I.
Okay. And your sister, Ava?
My sister is also in Israel. Mm-hmm. She does not write books at all. She lives in Jerusalem, and she used to be an ophthalmologist, so she retired. Both of my brother and sister retired.
Then I had a question. What about your grandfather who oversaw sending your...
Oh, Benno Jacob.
What was his first name?
Benno Jacob.
B-E?
B-E-N-N-O.
Okay. Jacob.
Jacob.
Who was your mother's?
He was my mother's father. Uh-huh. And he was one of the most renowned biblical scholars of the past century, if I may say so.
Is that right?
And his books, although he published his... tried to publish his book just in 1933, was not a good time in Germany to publish it. But lately, especially German people in Germany and Israel are looking again at his books, which my husband has translated to a certain extent. And in fact, we just had a symposium a few years ago in Germany on Benno Jacob.
Is that right?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Did he get out of...
Just got out.
He got out. Mm-hmm. I worried about him.
He got out. He went to England. And I only know him really as a scholar and not as a grandfather. He wasn't that kind of a person. But he always had his notebooks with him, and he was always writing or studying, and had phenomenal memory. He corresponded with his colleagues in Greek and Latin, and that is also something. And in fact, he was my Hebrew teacher, but he was not good with children.
You didn't sit on his knee and play with his
beard? Oh,
no.
The last thing.
Well, he left.
No, but he was my sister and I went every week to our religious class with him, but it's only later in life that I realized that she really wasn't a teacher for children.
Right. Okay. And then I was curious, how did your father become established in London? Did he speak English when he...
He spoke some English.
Mm-hmm.
We children, when we were in Germany and my parents talked about emigrating, they turned to English, thinking that we won't understand.
Oh.
But with the situation in Germany, we started a foreign language, English, very early.
Mm-hmm.
So we understood quite a bit already. When my father he was an insurance broker and had connections with Lloyd's of London. So he was able to establish himself there because he had some connections. Mm-hmm. And they were very good to him, really.
Lloyd's of London?
Lloyd's of London was very good to him. As a matter of fact, in the Blitz, when my father's office was totally destroyed in the city, you know, that center, London, the business center, he was standing in front of the building, sort of tears in his eyes, and somebody from Lloyd's came by, and he said, "Mr. Lowenthal, you let us give you an office, and you can look through our files to set things up again."
Marvelous.
Yeah, the English were really terrific.
In a way, in listening to the tape, I had I got the impression that the English were quite reserved.
They are reserved.
But kind.
They were very kind, mm-hmm. and the war brought things out. For example, we never talked to our neighbors. Mm-hmm. Didn't do that so easily, not like in America.
They were English.
English,
Jewish?
English, yeah, I think so, on one side English, Jewish, but you didn't talk to each other like you do here. And but with the war, people mm-hmm. started mm-hmm. to break
a
down
common
a bit.
Yeah. Dilemma.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Then I wondered if you could tell us with a little more depth about the two jobs you had in London. One was you were secretary to the Friends of Hebrew University. That was your first job.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And all I know is that all I heard was that you ushered Martin Buber and his daughter on a tour. But what about the job? Could you tell us something
well,
about
I
what
was the
Friends...
low man on the totem pole, let's put it that way.
Okay. It was your first job.
It was my first job, my first... I really wanted to be employed in the musical world, to be a secretary, and I have to tell you a funny story. I wrote to Sir Thomas Beecham. Ever heard of him?
Of course I've heard of him. He was a great conductor.
If he needed me as a secretary.
Did you? Did he?
No. Well, I'm afraid not.
Oh. You went right to the top.
Yeah, I didn't fool around.
Well, what did the Friends of Hebrew University do?
The Hebrew University needed money.
They were
raising money, and a lot of English Jews were interested. For example, Norman Bent, which I got to meet a lot of very, very nice people. And he stuck out in my mind.
Ooh, Martin.
Norman Bentwich. He's very well known.
Spell it?
Norman, Bentwich.
Got
he
it.
Did a lot for the Hebrew University, as did Brodetsky. All the people who later took quite an enormous part in the establishment of the State of Israel. I met all these people.
At the Friends of Hebrew
At the
University.
Friends of the Hebrew right. University, although I was the secretary and the youngest, and, you know. The girl who made the tea.
But these were English people?
Oh, yeah. English Jews.
English mm-hmm. Jews. Okay.
Yeah. The head was Walter Zander. Z-A-N-D-E-R. And it's funny, I still remember the names of these people.
And do you forget the names of people you met a week ago?
Yeah. Not those.
I know about that. Then also you worked at the Jewish Agency, which
I
you said was
I worked at the Jewish Agency. I worked in the Major Lee gave his, I was his secretary, he gave out visas to, he was in charge of getting visas for people. A lot of our people, like, came from Europe and did not have a British passport, but had Nansen paper. You ever heard of Nansen paper?
How do you spell that?
N-A-N-S-E-N.
No, I never heard of it.
These are... it's not a passport. but it's a paper on which the visas are printed. Some of our people had enormous, I can't think of it now, any of the names, but these were all people who were very high up in government, had enormous, and each time I had to go to the foreign office and get another visa printed for them.
I see.
Yeah, they did not have British passports.
I see, so that in order to get a visa, they had to
you. Had to have the Nansen paper.
And you would get the, then you would get the
I was the one
who were the people that were emigrating? Were these people coming from Europe to England?
No, these were mainly, I got the visas mainly for the politicians.
Okay.
At that time.
Well,
then later, with the war in 1948, we had a lot of people who volunteered to fight there. Jews and non-Jews, a lot
right?
of non-Jews,
didn't know that.
Especially pilots from South Africa. And we saw to it that we interviewed them to see if they were kosher. And as you can imagine, somebody coming to your office and volunteering to fight for the Haganah. Wasn't so easy, obviously. You had to get to.
You had to be careful.
You had to be careful.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's the.
Yeah. I was really in the midst of things. The Jewish Agency was 77 Great Russell Street, which is, if you go to London, right next door to the British Museum.
Oh, I've been to the British Museum.
Yeah, well, it's
yeah.
right next door.
I don't know
what that building is now, but 77 Great Russell Street. Was a sort of a password in Jewish, British Jewish language. Everybody knew that was a
special
Jewish
meaning.
Yeah.
Like number 10 Downing Street.
That's right.
Oh. Well, then you were in the thick of things, and that was
I really
a very
was
exciting
in the
time.
Thick of
say.
Things, mm-hmm. and yes, it was exciting. And then I volunteered to go to Israel in 48, but my boss, Major Lee, major in the British Army he was, wouldn't let me because my brother already volunteered. And he said, one in the family is enough.
Oh, that was kind.
Yeah. Before that, I also tried to work, to go to Europe, you know, to work in the concentration camps.
To get the displaced people?
Yeah, but I did not get in. My family thought.
Not a good thing.
I was
you were
too young.
But adventuresome, to say
yes.
the least.
I always
yeah,
was.
That's wonderful. Lucky. First of all, I'm touched by the fact that English people were volunteering to go and fight because they had sort of kept it, made it very difficult for the Jews at one point.
Would English people, English Jews?
No. Oh, these were English Jews that were.
Well, there were Jews,
Jews
and there were
non-Jews.
Non-Jews.
I think
yeah, from all over the world they came.
They went to fight.
And volunteered to fight.
I don't think we know enough
really
about that.
Really, you don't know that?
No.
Interesting.
No.
Oh, yeah.
They stopped. Did you? Mm-hmm. No, I did not. That's a very, very, it's very meaningful to me that happened, that non-Jews went to
yeah,
fight.
Yeah, I wonder if it's ever written up. That sort of thing. I've not come across it.
I haven't.
I have. I really have to look, you know.
Yeah.
Do
well, I know that you went to Israel at the age of 19, and I wondered if you would describe more fully than we got on the first tape what Israel was like culturally, politically, when you were there.
I came so. Just after the war, mm-hmm. when Israel was established, mm-hmm. in October, we were idealists in those days.
Yes,
I'm afraid it's not that much so anymore. It's changed a great deal. But we were idealists. I went by myself in the beginning, and I really didn't quite know what I really wanted to do, so I tried my hand at the kibbutz, Kfar Blum. Kfar Blum was in kibbutz of English Jews. I was there, I lasted a weekend. Did I tell you that last time?
Rats.
With the rats, yeah. And so that was very difficult. I went to Jerusalem to my aunt, and...
You had an aunt living?
I had an aunt, yeah. I had relatives in Israel.
Okay.
But, and she didn't steer me. She gave me something to bring to somebody in Haifa, which I did, and those people...
Did she give you a letter, like a letter of introduction?
No, she wanted me to bring something to a friend of hers,
okay.
And I brought it to them, Dualaha, Dr. Dualaha, and they asked me what I was doing and would I like to live in Haifa, and they had half a room to rent, half a room, mind you. And so I agreed to that. They were very nice. They were also German Jews. He was a doctor, heart specialist in Haifa. And so I came to Haifa and shared a room with a nurse. And we got on very well. And I stayed with that. I rented the room for a long time with the door locked. Then I started to work with it. Did I tell you last time with the Arab social worker?
Yes, you did.
Okay, and then I got into to be an X-ray technician.
Right, and you went to Tel Aviv.
And later I went to Tel Aviv.
Right. And what was it like? Can you describe it?
What Israel was like at that time.
Yeah.
We had nothing. It was a status symbol to have nothing.
It was a pioneering
atmosphere. It was a pioneering atmosphere. The Carmel was still beautiful. They were gorgeous. Pine trees up there. Now I can tell you, now that I'm in the horticulture business, Pinus halepensis, the whole Carmel was full, and people were very, you know, a bus driver who were the elite at that time in Israel. If you married a bus driver, you really reached the top, because the agate. The business was running very well. You know, they'd stop for you, they saw you, they knew you, you worked in the X-ray department, so they'd stop in the middle of the street. I hardly had to put up my hand. It was that kind of a very informal atmosphere. People had very little. And, for example, never had a bathtub or meat or anything like that. I didn't,
it was Spartan.
It was Spartan, but we were not unhappy. Not a bit unhappy.
It sounds like there was a great feeling of camaraderie.
Lots of camaraderie, lots of friendship, easily made. I was British and I had my parents, my colleagues from all over Europe had no parents. So I really was, you know, really dead to talk about that, because they were, most of them were survivors. I think in the end, in Tel Aviv, we had one Sabra, you know, a girl there, the rest was from all over Europe. Yeah, later on when I worked in Tel Aviv in a hospital, we were about 14 nationalities in the department.
But you were united with a common goal, I suppose, to survive,
well,
and
we,
to keep things
work. Well, you know, we were interested in building up Israel at that time. And we need, when you're young, you need awfully little. It's really amazing.
It's a wonderful way to feel, that you're not grasping for things. It comes, that seems to come later, I guess.
Well, I don't think it's ever come to me. I think if you're raised that way, I don't think when you grow up, these things are very important to you.
You know, I think that's true, that materialistic people are taught to be materialistic from an early age.
I don't know. But our children are different.
Okay. I heard that you... Do you have anything to do with the Israeli army? Were you in the army?
No,
you
I was not in the army. I had just, you can live I'll tell you why.
Okay.
When you were in the Israeli army, you got a pittance financially. That's okay if you have somewhere to live, mm-hmm. if you have a family to mm-hmm. go to weekends. I did not have a family to go to. I'd still have to pay my rent in the room, so I really couldn't afford to go into the army.
Right. I yeah. thought it was mandatory, that's why I...
Well, it is after a few years. In fact, I just, before I left, uh-huh. which is after 10 years, I thought I'd have to go to the army, but then I didn't come back because I got married.
Right. I see. So that came later, that
Yes,
uh-huh.
But the reason really was that I couldn't afford to join
right.
the army.
I understand.
But I didn't have a rent and no room, not even half a room.
Right. Okay. Then you started the docent program at FIPS. Could you tell us about starting it and mm-hmm. what how it happened and so on?
I was a docent at the museum in the first class, and I thought if you could do it for pictures, you'd do it for plants too. FIPS at that time had absolutely no education programs at all, and in fact nothing was, hardly anything was labeled even. And I walked in there and had the chutzpah to label everything.
Did you really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And went down, FIPS at that time was under the city, not private like now, of course. And I went to Louise Brown, she was the head of Parks and Recreation, and tried to interest her.
And what year was this?
Hmm?
Around what year was this?
Hmm. Like 78, 79, something like that. And she was interested as long as it didn't affect her bottom line. And we started it. I got a few people together and we advertised for volunteers and started it. And I taught for many, many years. I had over 100 people, some of them are still there.
Is that right?
And some of them are docents in the Biblical Garden.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of fun together. I arranged a lot of tours together around Pennsylvania or near Pennsylvania, even Florida, to visit gardens. For some reason, the director of FIPS at that time had really never visited any other gardens.
Oh, never.
And I really introduced him to other gardens, and he's not there anymore.
But you set up a training program.
I set up, yeah. Not only did I set up the training program, at that time I took reservations for tours. I scheduled the docents.
Okay,
I telephoned when constantly
job.
At home.
I can believe it.
Yeah, did everything. Now,
can you arrange for a docent and to go through FIPS? Is that possible?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
I didn't know that either.
Oh, sure. There's still the docent program's going very well.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they just started a new class.
Is that right? And they have new people coming
new
in?
New people are coming in, yeah.
That's terrific.
In fact, one of our docents is now also taking the docent class.
Is that
FIPS.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there's
it's going very well, the docents in FIPS.
How about the docents? We might as well talk about the docents.
Our docents.
Yeah.
Doing very well, too. Uh-huh. In fact, proud to say that in 14 years we have only lost two docents due to death and one docent to voice
mm-hmm.
didn't speak loud enough, but otherwise with the same group
is that right?
After 10 years, I have a few more people, but as a matter of fact, we do need more docents, and I'm thinking of teaching again to get some more docents for the Biblical Garden.
How long a course is it for the Biblical Garden? How many times do they have to come for class? Does a docent trainee have to come for class?
Docent trainee, about 8 times.
Okay.
They get a lot of literature.
I beg your pardon?
They get a lot of literature.
And they can read up on things. Okay. Then I'm going to jump to the Biblical Garden itself. And we talked about it on the tape, but I have been there, and perhaps Ruth saw it, so we didn't get on tape the vision, the idea, the philosophy of the Biblical Garden.
Why did we do this?
Yeah, and
just to show people what kind of a life the ancients really led, very much like our lives, and they knew much more than we give them credit for. In medicine, in many ways, really, and that's why we have also these special exhibits each year. Just to show people, for example, this year we have King Tut's vegetable garden. Last year we had textiles, the textiles you used in ancient time, plants you used for textiles in ancient time, in modern time. And the need for paper and papyrus, the paper, and also in medicine, for example, very early, people had already cataract operations in ancient times.
Well, Egypt was very sophisticated medically, weren't they, in biblical
times? Might call it like that. We have a lot of, when we did ancient medicinal plants, I had pictures, for example, of people with all sorts of diseases that they actually made drawings or made sculptures of these people. It's really amazing, so that we really know what's going on.
And we're reverting back to that now in medicine, I think.
Well,
I don't know that I know much about it, but that's the
But we know a lot from there. For example, we know a lot about the teeth, because their grain was often mixed with sand, you know, from the desert. So the teeth wore down very quickly.
Then we talked about Horizon Home, and certainly you spoke very clearly about the difficulty in getting a home, the home itself, and how you did get the home on Negley Avenue, and that Murray Levine was such a great help. But what are there, were there other hurdles besides getting the property to getting this home started? What were the problems?
The hurdles were, first of all, it was the first group home in Western Pennsylvania.
Okay. Can I know what year was that around? Around what year was that?
I thought I wrote that in.
His before Phipps Conservatory, so.
What
is
God,
before that?
You see my Georgia.
It's in the 70s. So.
Huh?
Wouldn't you guess it was in the 70s?
There was no group home in Western Pennsylvania
before. Right.
So this was really a pilot program. And in order to see what there is,
it was a residential home, is that correct?
Yeah.
That was not just a school where kids could come to.
It was not a school.
It was a home.
A home.
Okay, yeah. A residential home. Okay.
Residential home.
Okay.
I don't know whether I talked about, you know, we had a daughter.
Yes.
And tried to find a home for
yes.
her and didn't find anything.
Right.
So we went to this 1212 North Negley, which was we thought just ideal. And we also went to Connecticut, which had the best group homes at the time, and looked at them, and came back and raised the funds to buy this home, to run it. We had some very good people to run it, and we had, I think, about 14 children.
How many?
14.
14?
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of kids.
Well, yeah, and they were all, but they went to programs outside the home.
And what age?